I'm Alex Beigelson. This week on the Issue Is podcast, perhaps the most effective and influential legislator in the history of the United States government, Nancy Pelosi, visited our station this week to talk about her new book, The Art of Power, which I really loved and recommend. And we talked about so much. We talked about the book. We talked about her role in what's happened with President Biden, where Kamala Harris goes from here. We talked about legislating, her as a master legislator, the lessons learned from that, her experience with, a crazy person attacking her husband who's still dealing with that, the attack on the Capitol on January 6th, the real story of what happened with Obamacare and how she called in a lot of favors to make that happen, how she researches her members, how California shaped her view, her thoughts on Adam Schiff, her thoughts on Gavin Newsom and some of his recent activity on homelessness, the people that impacted her the most, what she learned from them about the art of power. It's a almost hour-long conversation. She showed up like 45 minutes early, so I said, I'm going to take every second that I could. And I did, and I wish I had another hour or two because I could keep going because there's so much to learn from her. The book is tells, you know, the fact that she was basically the leader, the speaker or the Democratic leader for over 20 years. And so everything that's happened in our political history, basically, for the last couple decades, she's been at the center of. It was a really fascinating conversation. This is a special one that we'll never forget. So here is Speaker Emerita, Nancy Pelosi. Nancy Pelosi, welcome back to The Issue Is.
My pleasure to be here, Alex.
And her book is the number one bestseller on the New York Times. It's called The Art of Power, My Story as America's First Woman Speaker of the House. And I'm assuming you're a fan of Hamilton, right?
I am, but I'm more of a Jefferson person.
Okay. Well, Hamilton, okay. So,
the
but in the musical,
Hamilton.
Of course, they have that great song, The Room
Where
It Happens,
yeah.
Right? And this book takes you inside the room where it happens and some of the most important historic moments of the last 20 years as you served as speaker and leader and even beyond that as well. And I loved that it seemed like the premise was everybody else has said stuff about what happened to you and this is your chance to say what actually happened to you. So there's been a lot that's happened in the room in the last month and a half. If you were writing that chapter of what's just happened in our country, how does that chapter go?
Well, that's for another book, another time. Right now, how it goes is that we have to win the election, and that was the urgency of some of the decisions that were made then, because we do believe that this is a very different kind of election. It's not as if we're running against George Bush or Mitt Romney or Bob Dole. We're running against someone who has, in my view, disrespected the office he held and dishonored the oath of office he took.
And so your thinking was that at this point, Joe Biden couldn't win the election, and that's why there needed to be a change.
Quite frankly, Alex, it was more with the campaign as it was going forth, we needed a different approach. And the campaigns are something that first you make a decision to win. Mm-hmm. And then you make every decision in favor of winning. And sometimes that is reevaluating the approach that you're taking. And I wanted the campaign to be more, shall we say, on a path to victory. It didn't mean we had to change the candidate. That was the decision the president made.
And so he made that decision. And by all reports, you haven't spoken with him since, right?
No, that's only been about 3 weeks. So that's not a long time.
Have you spoken with the vice president since?
Oh, yes. Yes, I'm
and what have those conversations been
well,
like?
Well, we've had our big event in San Francisco. In 4 days, we raised over $13 million for her campaign, so it was pretty exciting. I introduced her at that event, and I had spoken to her before. He's the president. I'm no longer the speaker or no longer the leader. So what would be our normal course of conversation about legislation and the rest, we would not be having that conversation anymore. In addition to which, in this Congress of the United States, we were dismissed early by the Republican leadership because they couldn't pass a rule on their side to bring up legislation. So there's really nothing on the legislative agenda for us to talk about.
You know, there are some critics who say that this was a coup. They say that
Kamala Harris didn't get any votes in the primary, even though she was on the ticket, she wasn't the head of the ticket, and that it's anti-democratic for this to happen. What do you say to those critics?
Well, I think that they're stupid. I think it's really stupid.
Why is that?
Yeah, it's really stupid. He decides not to run. She puts her name out there. Anybody else could have put their name out there, too. They didn't. The president endorsed her. That was a big boost, of course. But the word coup, unless they don't know what that word means, it's really a dumb statement for them to make.
In terms of...
But just to be blunt, I'm going to save time here.
Yeah. She's a daughter of San Francisco.
Well, of the Bay Area. She grew up in Oakland. Yeah. She succeeded in San Francisco. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when you started in Congress, there were 12 Democratic women.
That's all.
Now there are 94 Democratic women. The concept that there could be a female president from the Bay Area, what does that mean to you?
It's exciting. Let me just say, it's important to note that when you say there were 23 altogether, 11 Republicans, 12 Democrats, out of 435 members, 23 out of 435. So it was, when I got there, it was like, this has to change. We have to make it, because I came from being a state party chair. I knew how to win elections, and here we go. I always thought that we would have a woman president long before we would have a woman Speaker of the House, because in the Capitol, it's like breaking the marble ceiling. The dominance of the men historically was just such that they couldn't even imagine that there would be a woman leader. But I thought the American people were ready. So I was very disappointed when Hillary Clinton did not win. I think the public is farther down the road even now, and it's pretty exciting. I know her for decades.
Right.
She's a person of great faith, which is reflected in her community service and the rest. She's a person of great... that's personally. Officially, she's strong. She knows her issue. She knows her strategy. She knows how to communicate it, as we see most recently with the woman's right to choose, but other issues, of course, globally and domestically. And she's politically very astute. So personally strong, officially strong, politically astute, knows how to win difficult elections.
What do you think is the most important thing that she needs to do at the convention next week in terms of priorities of issues or the way to go forward on this campaign?
Well, she needs no advice from anyone. She has made great strides right in a short period of time to become the nominee of the Democratic Party for President of the United States. She comes on the shoulders of Joe Biden, an agenda that is so consequential for our country. The rescue package, which created jobs, shots in arms, money in pocket, children in school, jobs, 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 her infrastructure package, jobs, 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 and again, protecting the environment, chips in science, jobs, 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 and not only jobs, but science to enhance our preeminence in the world technologically and involve many more people in that pursuit, more diversity, more women, STEM, and all research. The PACT Act, honoring our commitment to our veterans, especially those exposed to burn pits, and they are taking advantage of it already. IRA to save the planet, $370 billion to save the planet, nothing like it any place in the world, but in that bill. And today is a very special, triumphant day for us, because in that bill, we achieved something we've been trying to do for a while, and that was to enable the Secretary of HHS to negotiate for lower drug prices. Mm. We finally won that. We had been passing it in the House for decades, but we couldn't get it passed in the Senate, but we did under Joe Biden. And today, the HHS Secretary announced the reduced prices. If you see them, it's remarkable how much, like one-fifth of what it would have cost, because Big Pharma was charging our consumers here so much more than overseas. So this was And the president and the vice president announced this in Maryland. Sure. Some of us were invited to be there, but I'm here. So.
Thank you for choosing us over them, I guess. That makes me feel good.
Well, but it's such a triumphant day. We're so thrilled, yeah.
You know, one of the challenges next week for the convention, and we see this at speech after speech, is what's happening with the protesters of Gaza. How should that be handled by the Democratic Party?
Well, I think the public should, and those who are protesting, should appreciate better what the Democratic Party has done. And some of them want to ignore that. We view Hamas as a terrorist organization. What they did on October 7th was a horrible thing. Mm-hmm. We feel very concerned about the collateral damage to civilians in Israel's response. But Joe Biden and the Democrats have been the ones who were calling for humanitarian assistance for the Palestinians. But the people out there, we keep saying, say something about Hamas, say something about freeing the hostages. Mm. But all they want to do is say genocide, Joe, and all of that. So we really have to communicate in a stronger way. Kamala is meeting with I was in Michigan yesterday, as a matter of fact, and met with some of the people who are concerned about this issue are in Michigan. They came to our event. And some of them who have met with her have decided that they would support her. I mean, you have to understand, the other side is Donald Trump, who is not with them at all. Mm. Is not with them at all. So you're saying, well, whose interest are you serving by taking what Israel's doing out on Joe Biden? Joe Biden has been, as many of us are, strong supporters of Israel, have been, because it's in the interest of our country to do so, because we have shared values, and because Israel has a right to defend itself, but not at the cost of all of those children and the civilian collateral damage. But we just have to have a ceasefire. We have to have war be eliminated as a civilized way to resolve conflict. Mm. It's becoming outside the circle of civilized human behavior because of the tragedy that it is for individuals, for people, for families, for communities, for the environment.
Yeah, so the basic message to the protesters is the alternative is a whole lot worse.
Well, no, but you have a legitimate, we all share the concern right. about the civilian, but let's share also concern. Who is holding up the ceasefire? Hamas. Yeah. They walked away from it the other day, and then Israel said, well, if they're walking away, then sure. you know, there's no thing. And so they should be, I think, recognizing Hamas's role in this, and now it could lead to even a further conflict. I myself have disagreed with Israel on settlements, really. Mm-hmm. For decades, I've disagreed with them on settlements, and that is provocative of war another part of Israel and sure. the West Bank and stuff, but this is a horrible thing that has happened, and there's a lot of responsibility for it. They're saying if we weren't supporting Israel, this would not be happening. No, if Hamas had not assaulted Israel the way they did, this would not have been happening. But there have been generations of injustice as far as the Palestinians are concerned. And that has to be addressed.
We're talking with Nancy Pelosi, the author of The Art of Power, My Story as America's First Woman Speaker of the House. And you open this book with this just heart-wrenching story of the attack on your husband, Paul Pelosi. Yeah. This crazy guy breaks into your house, hits your husband over the head with a hammer.
Three times.
His hand needs to be reconstructed as well. Screaming, where's Nancy? The same thing that people were saying
in
the Capitol on January 6th. Mm-hmm. And we're glad to report your husband's doing a lot better, right?
It's getting there, about 80%, but thank you.
But just how, you also write about this moment with your daughter, Alexandra. And you said that when you first ran for Congress, she gave you her blessing when she was about 16, 17 years old.
Yeah.
And then after this attack, she said, I wish I could take my blessing back.
Yeah.
How did you process that moment?
Well, if I had known it was going to include a hammer on the head of my husband, I would not have even asked her for her permission. You see, we have 5 children, 6 years and 7 days.
Yeah.
4 of them are off to college. She's going to senior year. So I said, I've been asked to run, but next year would be better, but it's this year. Yeah. What do you think? And I won't run if you say that you want me to stay home. It's going to be about 3 days, 3 nights a week. I'll be in D.C., 4 days, 3 nights. And any answer is fine. And she said, get a life, mother. I say, mommy's been asked around for comment. She says, mother, get a life. And when she went to mother, I knew, yeah, I was in a little trouble. I'd never heard the expression get a life before then. That was a long time ago. And then she said, what teenage girl wouldn't want her mother out of the house 3 nights a week? So it was funny then, but what she said was so. If we ever thought this was going to lead to an assault, a physical assault, and the, all of the trauma that goes with it for our family, not just my husband, the two of us, but our children and our grandchildren, especially since the former president, his family, Republican governor, others, Elon Musk, all making a joke of it.
Right.
I think it was just the funniest thing, and putting it online and getting funny responses to it. It's uncivilized.
I was reporting from the California Republican convention when Trump was literally laughing at you, and the whole crowd was laughing at you, which was disgusting. That a man was attacked, and to see that happening. And how do you process that? How do you process what your daughter said to you? And is all of this worth it?
Well, we have to limit, I mean, we've suffered and continue to suffer our assault, but we have to make sure that this is not, that violence, personally, personal attack, campaign attacks, violence in the Capitol has to be eliminated. Politics is supposed to be the nonviolent debate of ideas, not the physical battle of it. And it always has been since the beginning of our country. We've had a disagreement, the role of government, Democrats versus Republicans. You talked earlier about the room where it happens. When we're doing our bills, like the Affordable Care Act, it's the in the room where it happens, but it's also, I'm not giving up our shot. We're not giving up our shot. We're going to do this. And we'll try to find a bipartisan way. If not, we'll get it done one way or another. So so violence should have nothing to do with it. But we didn't really tell my husband about any of those other things.
Yeah.
He got thousands and thousands of letters and calls and messages of support and prayers and the rest, so that we focused on that rather than their inhumanity.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about your legislating, because you are a master legislator.
Well, I love being a legislator. Yeah. People always say to me, why didn't you run for some other office? I said, but I like the job that I have.
How do you define a master legislator? What does that mean to you?
Well, it means success. It means getting the job done. It means getting the job done. And it is people, I don't think the public really has any idea the hard work that legislators do at any level. I'm just talking about the Congress. When we have a bill, for example, the Affordable Care Act, there's so much gathering the intellectual resources, listening to the public, the outside mobilization, the inside maneuvering, the actual weighing the efficacy of one thing versus another. What is really going to work? What are the costs involved, and what is worth it or not. So it's really heavy lifting. Mm-hmm. But people, I don't think they really think that we think we go there and vote and go home or something. No, it's a heavy lift. But it's I consider myself almost like a maestro. It's an orchestration. You have a lot of talent, many different versions of the story that you have to. So I say I'm a maestro, but I really think of myself as a weaver, just weaving together the beautiful diversity of our caucus, making sure everybody knows that every thread is essential to our tapestry, and that even though we may not have unanimity all the time, we have consensus to get the job done. And you may not have your way one day, but tomorrow is another day, and you have your legislation then.
I think I've interviewed almost every member of the Democratic caucus in California, and talked to many of them privately about you. And the thing that they all say about you is that your knowledge of them and their district, maybe more than their own knowledge of themselves and their district. Can you talk about the way you research And your knowledge of everybody and their individual pain point and their individual needs.
Well, it wasn't so much research as experience. I was Northern chair of the California Democratic Party for a while. Then I was chair of the California Democratic Party. And I know these congressional districts. I know the grassroots down to the last blade of grass. I know how different they are one from the other, and different within the mm-hmm. districts. You know, if you're more coastal versus more inland in your district, you have a consistent message, but recognizing that it will be heard differently other different places. So, and I've helped elect many of them over the years, so I know the challenges that they face. They bring so much. Our state is the intellectual political resource for the country. Mm. It is, many come from the legislature, state, local elections, or from the private sector, whatever it happens to be. And they understand that what we do in California is, as Gavin likes to say, a preview of the future for everybody
nation's
else.
Coming attractions.
The coming attraction for the country. So we have a big responsibility. So we prioritize carefully. And I always say to them, I'm sure you know your district better than I do, but I know the issue probably better than you do. So let's see where we can find our connection here.
Let's talk about the Affordable Care Act. You tell this story of a woman named Elena Hung, whose daughter, Ziamora, when your speaker portrait was unveiled in 2022, she basically said that her daughter is alive today because of you. And you describe it as, what greater compliment is that? How do you, I mean, of all the things you have done, it does that fill your heart kind of the most in terms of the Affordable Care Act?
Well, when I went housewife, house member, house speaker, and people said, what advice do you have to someone else? I say, know your why. Mm-hmm. You have to know why are you leaving to do this? Well, of course, my kids were grown by then. It's a different story, almost grown by then. Mm-hmm. So know your why. My why has always been the 1 in 3 children in America who lives in poverty, mm-hmm. goes to sleep hungry. So it's always about the children. What are the three most important issues facing the Congress? I always say the same thing. Our children, our children, our children. Their health, their education, the economic security of their parents, safety, and including from gun violence, but a safe, clean environment in which they can thrive, a world at peace in which they can reach their fulfillment and the fulfillment of our country. So it's everything mm-hmm. is about the children. So, but these moms of children with some challenges mm-hmm. do not stand in the way of them and public policy. They're there to get the job done.
Yeah.
And they're an inspiration to all of us. So when we were passing the bill, but when we were saving the bill, the eloquence, the determination, just the value system and the vision of these families with children with one form of disability or another were our inspiration. And some of them, it was a matter of life and death, and that's what she was talking about.
I mean, describe the emotion, though, when you hear that.
Well, it makes it all worth it. I mean, it's really worth it, because it's a justice issue, too, in our country. Before the Affordable Care Act, some of these children would have 2 or 3 operations within the first year of their lives, and sometimes more. They would have millions of dollars in bills. And by the way, they would have a pre-existing medical condition for the rest of their lives, depriving them of access to affordable care. And they would have annual or lifetime limits on what would be covered by insurance. All gone.
Yeah.
All gone. Out the door. In fact, even being a woman was no longer a pre-existing condition. Women paid maybe 50% more than a man for the same care.
You know, that's
similar care. Won't be the same.
That bill's pretty popular now. It was a challenge politically back then. And you write about the process of getting it done, including, mm-hmm. which is interesting, your own Catholic faith and one particular member who represents Notre Dame.
Yeah.
And you called in a favor. What'd you do?
Well, it wasn't a favor. It was One of our members, Val Catholic, just to make the distinction, there was nothing in the bill that would prevent anyone who was pro-life from voting for it. Mm-hmm. People who had written what was called the Hyde Amendment, restricting access to terminating a pregnancy unless life, liberty, life, incest, rape, you know, those three exceptions. And so that was honored in the bill. And so some of the people who wrote that, who are the pro-life people, said, this is not in the bill, we're voting for the bill. Mm-hmm. But some of the Catholic bishops wanted to use this as an opportunity to take down Roe v. Wade, and they would even sacrifice health care access to all Americans in order to accomplish their goal of taking down Roe v. Wade, which they eventually did with Donald Trump and his justices in the Roe court. But I called Father Hesburgh, who was just the hero of heroes. He marched with Martin Luther King. He's been just a champion of values in our country for a long time. He had been the president of Notre Dame. He still lived there. I visited him there, smoked his cigars, told his stories and all that. So I called him and said, Mr. President, well, I called him Father. I'm having some trouble with the bishops, but I want you to know that there's nothing in the bill. And I told him the people who were pro-life, who were supporting the bill because of the integrity of the bill. And I said, but I need to, what can I do to help? I said, well, Joe Donnelly, we need your support there. So he said, give me his number. So he calls me, he says, Congressman Donnelly, the Speaker and I need your vote on the Affordable Care Act. So I didn't tell anybody because I had several tactics that, you know, I kept close. And then I was going into the cloakroom from the floor. Cloakroom is where members gather off the floor. And I could hear them saying, you should see what she did to me. You should see what she did to me. Some of them in humor, some of them borderline. And then he said, you should see what she did. It was like the Pope calling me Father Hesburgh. So as long as he said it, then I thought I can put it in the book.
Yeah.
Now he's the ambassador to the Holy See.
Under the Vatican.
He went to the Senate after the House, and now the ambassador to the Holy See. He and his wife, they're so lovely.
And so so the bill eventually passes. But then later there's this fight to keep it. And John McCain ends up being a saving grace. Yeah. And we will always remember that image of him voting with the thumbs down.
But thumb you down had, heard around the world.
You had a heads up to that.
Yeah.
What did he say to you?
He said he intended to vote against it. And what he did also say is he had said, I wouldn't be able to support a bill unless we had the proper process. So the Republicans in the House said, oh, we're going to do that, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. So when we chatted on the phone, I said, you know, Senator, they're not doing any of that. They just went into the Rules Committee and said, forget all that, we're just proceeding. He said, you don't have to tell me what's going on. Mm. I know what's going on. And as it is now, I will be voting against him.
And you think about without him.
But I didn't tell anybody.
Yeah.
Anybody, not one soul. I don't know who else he may have told, but I didn't tell him one soul. It probably didn't tell Mitch McConnell because he seemed surprised.
He did. You know how to count the votes, but he had counted that vote for John McCain as an aye, and it was a no.
But let me just say this, because there's a really important thing here. When they made the assault 60, 70 times to weaken or overturn the Affordable Care Act, to get rid of it, we had an outside mobilization. In order to pass it, we had inside maneuvering and outside mobilization. All these patient groups, so many, you know, the nuns, forget the bishops, the nuns, all there. And to pass it. Then when this assault happened, we had 10,000 events around the country where people came and told their story. They didn't talk about provisions in the bill, they talked about their story. My child was born this way, my sister had this, you know, whatever their story was, 10,000 of them. And that generated hundreds of thousands of calls to the Capitol It didn't persuade many on the Republican side, but it did change the tide of acceptance of the legislation, which you opened this segment about.
And there's no more personal issue than health care.
No,
the most
it is.
Personal. Yeah. So you write that in 2016, you thought that Hillary Clinton was going to win.
Yeah.
Most everybody thought Hillary Clinton was going to win.
Yes.
And then you thought if she was in there, the Affordable Care Act was safe.
Yes, that's
and
right.
you were considering maybe you could go home.
Yeah.
Obviously, she didn't win.
No.
There was plenty of fighting back with Donald Trump. Affordable Care Act still in place, though.
Yeah.
If Kamala Harris, the daughter of the Bay Area, becomes the president of the United States and you feel comfortable, would you consider, is that a good time to go? Or have you thought about that?
No, I haven't thought about it at all.
Yeah.
All I think about is winning this election because everything is at stake.
Yeah.
Women's right to choose, our democracy. One of the things that we want to do when she wins is something that we just couldn't do because of the Senate, we've done it in the House again, is to democratize our democratic system, to enable people to stop voter suppression, to stop partisan redistricting, to stop big, dark, special interest money for coming in big. So if we pass our bill, they can still give because the Roe Court has said they could give, a terrible decision, saying people could give any amount of money, corporations are people.
Mm-hmm.
Well, people can only give a certain amount, but corporations can give endlessly. I haven't gotten that, the logic of that, except that it was a political thing the court did. But we're saying you can, if the court said you can, but it has to be disclosed. So if we can do that, we can get gun violence, protect background checks, we get a woman's right to choose, we can raise the minimum wage, we can do issues that relate to the LGBTQ community, our Equality Act in that regard. There's a whole slew, immigration reform. We can do all of that because we will not be relying so much on the 60 votes.
So it sounds like you want to stick around for a while.
Well, I'm running in this term. But I'm on a mission. I'm not on a timetable.
Yeah.
And right now, as you saw with the change in the, shall we say, the dynamic in the last few weeks, we're on a path, but it's hard. You have to, I say the three M's, you have to mobilize and own the ground.
Yeah.
So you get out every possible vote. You have to have a message that is bold and progressive, but not menacing. It's unifying for the country. Mobilization, message, and the third M is money to get the job done, and largely from small donors. You have to have three no's. No wasted time, no underutilized resources, and no regrets the day after the election that we could have done more.
And was that part of why you pushed for the Biden campaign to go in a different direction? That you had potential regrets, you thought that they were going to potentially lose, that you potentially lose the House. Was that the foundation of a lot of
that? Well, let me just say that Joe Biden is one of the most consequential presidents of modern times. As I said earlier, some of the things that he did, and that's just some of the things that he did. And 15 million jobs.
Sure.
The other guy, the worst job creation record since Herbert Hoover.
During COVID, though, some of that.
No, not during COVID.
Yeah.
Give it the one bill that they passed when they had the majority was to give a tax cut, a tax bill that gave 83% of the benefits to the top 1%, adding $2 trillion to the national debt.
Yeah.
And then saying, well, we can't feed children and all that because it's going to add to the national debt. But Joe Biden solved COVID. They were in denial and delay on COVID. Joe Biden came in with the rescue package, shots in the arms, money in the pockets, children in school safely, people back to work, a child tax credit taking 50% of the children off of out of poverty, the list goes on. Yeah, they had COVID, and we gave them $3 billion. No, $3 trillion to solve it in our bill. Investing that much money in it all, still the worst job creation record since, and when I say we, I mean when he was president and we were there.
You were the speaker, right.
So it
but the Democrats, Is it fair to say you think that the Democrats have a better chance now at winning the House, at winning those close congressional districts with Kamala Harris at the head of the ticket as compared to Biden?
Well, you can be the judge. There's been a tremendous amount of enthusiasm that has come forth, whether it's in terms of volunteerism in our districts for the House races, the Senate campaigns, local government too, and state government, and for the presidential. And Tim Walz has been a wonderful addition to that enthusiasm. I know him well. He served for 12 years in the House, and he became the top Democrat on the Veteran Affairs Committee, did more than was done since World War II for veterans. So, yes, there's been tremendous enthusiasm. And one of it was that so many young people were not enthusiastic about voting. Mm-hmm. They see two, shall we say, older people, both younger than me, but I am, but nonetheless, two older people. They're like, what? And so, yes, there's much more enthusiasm among young people. And in California, as you've seen, the numbers are so different for young people, LGBTQ, Asian American, Hispanic, and Black voters who were more lethargic about these two guys, but now they're very excited about her.
So once again, you were right.
Well, I don't know. We'll see. We have to win. We have to win, and it's not easy.
Yeah.
And I keep saying to you, it is not easy. Yeah, it's a campaign. That's a battle
right.
term.
And it's close. It's close.
It's battle, and you and that's what campaigns are about. They're close. And I know about elections. That's coming out of the Democratic Party.
Yeah.
As I did.
So we're talking to Nancy Pelosi, the author of The Art of Power. And, yeah. and one of the things you write about here, you take us inside the room on what happened on January 6th, which was
terrible.
Just heart-wrenching to read and to think of all these folks that are coming, screaming, where's Nancy? Where's
yeah.
Nancy? Your young staffers. And you describe the moment of seeing their faces.
Yeah.
Because you were first taken to a secure location, you come back to the Capitol, you see their faces. What do you see in their eyes?
Trauma, just so traumatized. I've never seen anything quite like it. They were just so frightened. They had for hours been under table in the dark with room closed, furniture up against the door. There were the other people were banging outside. They did get through one door, but they didn't get through the second door. Vicious remarks, crude, vicious. Defecation,
yeah.
you know, these are the Trumpites.
Literally human waste on your floor.
On the floors, but not in mine, but in the Capitol. And I think pretty soon some of them decided that they would do some other things rather than breathe. Because you don't want
to
be near the scene
back.
Of the crime.
Too painful to come back.
To come back to where that all yeah. happened. It was so sad. I'll never forgive them for that. I mean, the fact that they came back that night, the Republicans, after they saw all of that happen and did refuse to vote to certify the election, is that overwhelmingly, and their leadership across the board.
And many of them refused to impeach or acquit, or, sorry, convict Donald Trump in the impeachment trial, which would have knocked him out
yeah.
in terms of being
including
a potential
Mitch
candidate,
McConnell,
including Mitch McConnell.
Who just said, he was responsible. He made all yeah. the speeches as late as February 13th.
So you said when they were potentially coming to the Capitol, you made a comment about Donald Trump about what you wanted to do to him.
Well, in self-defense, he comes here, I'm going to beat him up. I know I could take him on. I mean, he's
yeah,
nothing.
You could take him. I mean, you also write about the difference between negotiating with George W. Bush, somebody you were publicly pretty critical of at
oh,
the time,
yeah. Yeah.
and
well,
Donald
in
Trump.
Iraq.
Two different Republican presidents. What's the main difference in negotiating with Bush versus Trump?
Well, first of all, let's say that Bob Dole, Mitt Romney, George W. Bush, now we're talking about somebody who actually was president, they're patriots. They care about our country. They honor their oath of office to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States. This guy is saying maybe we should terminate the Constitution.
Hmm.
This is a horrible creature. People should, I respect people who may find reasons why they want to vote for them. That's their choice. But I see him, and Kamala says, I've prosecuted people like him. I know people like him. I know him.
Mm.
And he cannot be president again. So when you ask that question, he has no respect for governance, for the office he holds, for the protecting the environment, the future of our children. All he's there for, tax cuts for the rich, and they're the ones who are funding his campaigns with huge amounts of money. They don't care about we the people of the United States in order to form a more perfect union and everything that else that our Constitution is about. And so he has the people who are discriminators, and he has the people who don't want to pay taxes or have any protections for clean air, clean water. They don't want any protections because it's all their bottom line. Yeah. And in between, you have some really concerned people about who don't know where their path is for their family because of innovation, because of globalization, some of them even because of immigration, but that's probably the least challenging to their job security. And Joe Biden has had an agenda that says to them, you are part of the economic prosperity of America. Mm-hmm. You don't have to go to college, but if you want to, there's opportunity. But you can make a good living in the trades and the rest of that because we have decent pay and respect for all of that, for the workers. So it behooves us to have more of that message out there, which is what I had hoped would happen too. Now, when people pay attention to the election, they'll see that. And I respect those people who may have thought, well, I saw the factory down the road move to China or Mexico or something, and he's going in, snake oil salesman that he is, making it sound like it's going to open again, but of course it didn't.
But you argue that with Bush, you could trust him.
Oh, yes. He was a person of his word.
To him, and that his staffers spoke for him. And you felt with Trump, you couldn't trust him, and that his staffers didn't speak for him.
They had to bring their phones in and have them open there so that he could hear everything that was going on until we threw that out. But George Bush, I mean, the father and son.
Yeah.
Bob Dole, people like that, they're great Americans. That's why I say take back the party. You've produced great leaders in our country, the grand old party, the Republican Party. What are you allowing it to become a cult to a thug?
Yeah.
And that's what has happened.
You know, I spoke to somebody who worked very closely for Donald Trump and knows his thinking. And he said that of all the Democrats, he respected you the most. He refers to you as a killer in a positive way because he thinks that you're the most ruthless in terms of operating in power. You understand the
strong.
Art of power.
I don't like ruthless. Ruthless sounds...
But he actually respects you more than any of the guys because he thinks you're the strongest of all of them. What do you think about that?
Well, what I'm saying is I'm for a purpose,
yeah.
You know, and I really know the issue. See, I never intended to run for Congress in the first place. And then when I was in Congress, I never intended to run for leadership. So I know the intelligence, 30 years on intelligence, 30 years, a long time on appropriations and stuff. Which enabled me, once I was in the leadership and continued to be in leadership on intelligence in leadership, to find a path. So I never would take no for an answer. When we were doing the Affordable Care Act and Senator Kennedy's seat was lost in Massachusetts, the press said to me, you're dead, you know, you're dead, it's over. I said, no, it's not over. We are not going to pass up an opportunity of a generation for access to health care for Americans, affordable, accessible health care. Well, what are you going to do? I said, we're not letting anything stand in our way. If there's something in the way, we'll push open the gate. If that doesn't work, we'll climb the fence. If that doesn't work, we'll pole vault in. If that doesn't work, we'll helicopter in. But we're not letting anything stand in our way.
Yeah.
So then they said after, well, which one did you do?
And he went through.
We just pushed open the gate.
Yeah.
You know why? Because he had that outside mobilization. You cited that example.
Sure.
I talked about the patient groups and the people who are saying, we have to have this. So our members and their courage and their strength and the outside mobilization. Inside maneuvering, outside mobilization. Lincoln, public sentiment is everything. With it, you can accomplish almost anything. Without it, practically nothing.
If Trump calls you a killer, what word would you use to describe him?
Grotesque.
Okay.
But I mean, there's so many others.
Yeah.
People say, use a gentler word. Now they're using weird.
Yeah.
And that has a market because it sounds descriptive. Yeah. It doesn't sound insulting. It's descriptive.
Yeah.
Grotesque. Yeah.
As we talk with Nancy Pelosi, two quick California questions, then I want to get go big picture. Adam Schiff, somebody that you have mentored very closely from the moment that he came
into... Well, he mentors me, too. We're all mentors to each other.
Can you talk about him and his race and what he means to you? Obviously, you're close with a lot of members, but it seems like it's a special relationship.
Well, I have a special relationship with many of our California members. We all have a history together.
Yeah.
Just to put it in perspective, go way back, we're in the 90s. We've lost 94, 96, 98. Three elections. We lost three elections. We had a Democratic president. We lost three elections. So in 2000, I said to the National Democrats, we'll take care of California. We'll raise our money. We'll choose our candidates. We'll take care of California. We'll help you raise for the rest of the country. So this was really how I merged in the leadership. Not that everybody thought we should have a woman, but because politics. Mm-hmm. So that I said to them, you need seven seats to win the House.
Mm-hmm.
I'll give you four in California. All you have to get is three in the rest of the country. That year, in the morning of 2000 election, we had 26 Democrats, 26 Republicans, of 52, mm-hmm. half and half. At the end of the day, we had 31 Democrats and 31 Republicans. Adam Schiff, Jane Harman, Susan Davis, Mike Honda, Hilda Solis. Five will get you 10 every time.
Mm-hmm.
31%. And Adam Schiff was one of those. It was the most expensive race in the country because he was running against one of the managers of the Clinton impeachment.
Mm-hmm.
And he's absolutely phenomenal. You know, he's brilliant, he's strategic, he's values-based and the rest. So he's been a star since he got there.
Gavin Newsom is now trying to crack down on homeless encampments around the state.
Yeah.
Some Democrats are pushing back on that. What do you think about that?
Well, I support the governor and what he's trying to do because it is, and I see in San Francisco, the issue. We have to have our sensitivities, our kindness to people. But on the other hand, it's a complicated issue.
Mm-hmm.
And many of the people, in fact, in San Francisco are homeless, are drug or alcohol users. That's just, unfortunately, the way it is. You don't want to punish them for consumption, but you have to arrest those who are committing a crime. Now, homelessness, again, there are opportunities for many people.
Mm-hmm.
I have been working on this issue for 37 years in the Congress. We've done homeless families, homeless veterans, everything. It's just a lot of issues. It's mental health, it's addiction, it's the cost of housing.
Yeah.
So what we want to do is have a gigantic, Maxine Waters is really very important in all this and very ambitious in all this, to how do we have more affordable housing? Low income, affordable, market rate to cover some of that,
mm-hmm.
but also the ability of people to purchase a home,
mm-hmm.
to purchase a home, that first down payment,
sure.
whatever it is. And there has to be a change in policy and access to affordable housing so that people are not taken off the street and into a shelter, but to transition housing and then to permanent housing. Cost of housing is part of it, but addiction and mental illness are parts of it as well.
As we wrap things up with Nancy Pelosi, the author of Art of Power, my story as America's first woman Speaker of the House, we do something on this show called the name game sometimes, where we say a name and then it's the first thing that comes to mind. But I wanted to do this with some of the people that I think you admire the most.
Yeah.
And I say the name, if you can think of maybe a sentence or two that they taught you in terms of the way you think about the art of power, okay?
Yeah.
You ready for this?
No, but anyway, go ahead.
Yeah.
why would I be ready?
Let's start with Congressman John Lewis, the most important lesson from him.
Oh, my gosh. John Lewis, the spark of divinity that exists in all of us, to be respected, and respected in ourselves so that we treat people with respect.
Lindy Boggs, who was there when you first started.
Yeah, Lindy Boggs, she said, know your power and use it.
Which is one of your mottos,
yes,
right?
Yes, it is. She taught me that.
Senator Barbara Boxer, who was Congresswoman Barbara Boxer when you first got there.
Barbara, oh, she was remarkable. Yeah. I mean, I love her, like, well, as a sister, and just love her very much. She was, she taught me a lot of things, because I was going in out of the kitchen. I mean, I hadn't been an elected officer. And she one important thing that I always remember is she said, never question people's motivation, respect them.
Senator Harry Reid, who you went through so many legislative battles with.
I love Harry. You know, Harry, oh gosh, he was really saintly in his service in the Congress. So what I'd say with him is, it's just be a workhorse. We're not workhorses. We're not show horses, we're workhorses. Yeah. And that meant a lot to me, because then we could really work together without grandstanding or taking credit or anything like that.
I know how important your Catholic faith is. Pope Francis.
Oh, Pope Francis, saintly, just beautifully, beautiful. And when I've seen him on occasion, he'll say, pray for me. And I'm like, no, you pray for me, okay?
The Dalai Lama.
Well, if this is the last one, the Dalai Lama, I have just loved for a long time. I mean, I've loved him. I've loved the Patriarch of the Greek Church. I love Pope Francis. These people are so values-based and so inspiring. But the Dalai Lama had me there. He's in India, in exile, but he had like a couple of hundred people, llamas, for lunch. And I talked to them about how we were going to take care of the Tibetans outside of Tibet, worry about those inside, do this or that, and I would say to the world that if we do not speak out for human rights in China, we lose all moral authority to speak about human rights any place in the world. The Dalai Lama gets up after I speak and said, now let us pray for Nancy, that we rid her of her negative attitude.
And wrapping up with three that I think you'll really like. Paul Pelosi.
No, just such a beautiful gentleman. Really, so lovely, so lovely.
I'm what has
so
he lucky. Taught you?
Well, he's so beautiful and so lovely, and he loved his mother so much.
Yeah.
So he's.
That was who was next on my list. Your mother.
No,
who
my mother.
I know
mother.
Is the key to so much of Baltimore's power.
Oh, my mother wanted me to be a nun, so what can I say? But she was wonderful. She seven children, my father being in politics. But she taught me from a political standpoint, I'm not going to personal, but a political standpoint, the grassroots volunteers are to be respected. And she spent a lot of time entertaining them and bring them together and listening to them and their ideas and the rest.
Yeah. And finally, your father, who was the mayor of Baltimore and a congressman, what did you learn from him?
Well, one thing I repeat about him is he said, when these people are so negative, he said, he who throweth mud loseth ground.
And as we just, last question, what is the most important question?
You didn't ask about
John
the president.
Joe Biden,
saintly, just saintly, beautiful, lovely man.
Barack Obama.
Oh, Barack Obama, he's great. I mean, just fabulous, and get the job done.
Yeah. Last question, what is the most important thing you want people to know about the art of power?
It's about respect. You know, people say, what is the secret? No, it's respect. Respect for the people that you're serving and listening to them and what they really want. Respect for the people that you're working with who will vote to do this so that you're putting consensus together. And respect for people who don't even agree with you because they represent their constituents. So I think respect is the most vital attribute to bring to any of it. Just always, and I always say, keep friendship in your voice and treat everyone as your friend, but know who your friends are.
I have so much respect for you. Thank you, thank you, thank you for, we've done this for many years. This is one of the greatest joys and one of the most incredible conversations we've ever had. Thank you for what you've given to our country.
Thank you, Alex.
And thank you for like a class on being a master legislator with the greatest teacher.
Thank you.
Nancy Pelosi, thank you very much.
Our thanks to Speaker Emerita Pelosi, and our thanks to you for listening to this very special edition of The Issue Is. Next week, another special edition of The Issue Is. We'll be in Chicago along with Speaker Emerita Pelosi and so many others as the former senator from California, former attorney general, former San Francisco district attorney, now vice president of the United States, becomes the Democratic nominee. So it should be a really interesting week and a really interesting week for California politics as well. Here we go. This is the fun part. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Alex Michelson. See you next week.